This is December, help me someone.
Sixth.
2009. I love these collaborative t-shirts. I'm going to look at the whole matter of selfishness and unselfishness as it's ordinarily understood, and as it's understood in more by people with a more sophisticated understanding of morality or virtue. I got onto this topic as I became aware of how much at this season, this holiday season, how much there is in the air about selfishness and unselfishness, and how many pressures we are all under from all different directions to be more giving, less selfish. And there's an article I've been hanging on to for years about this, all this stuff. It's a review of two books, a review in The New Yorker from, 8 years ago, actually. But this is, of course, timeless topic. So I'm going to read some of that and comment on it and read something else. It starts off, this is a review by Jim Holt of two books, one called How to Be Good and the other one called Being Good. Suppose you wish to achieve excellence in life, but you have no real talent for anything in particular. This would apply, I think, to most of us. You are not smart enough to be a great scientist or creative enough to be a great artist. You do not possess the native shrewdness to be a distinguished statesman or the exquisite taste and inherited wealth to be a legendary hedonist. Are you then doomed to mediocrity? There is a school of thought that says no. The idea is that even if you are not clever or beautiful or talented, you can still, through sheer force of will, be very, very good. You can go beyond the norms of everyday morality, being kind to people, not telling lies, giving the odd dollar to Oxfam, and devote all your energies to feeding the hungry and succoring the afflicted. In other words, you can become a moral saint. And then he raises the question, is it a wise idea to strive to be as good and self-sacrificing as possible? Is moral sainthood a form of human excellence one should aspire to? Is it indeed something each of us has a duty to aspire to? And these are the questions that are taken up in these two books. I think this is very important stuff for those of us in Zen practice to consider from time to time, because my sense is that a great many of us who come to this practice have a strong sense of morality, and all too often too strong a sense of morality, where we can get into trouble with our self-consciousness about our goodness or lack of it, our selfishness or lack of it. He says, philosophers over the past couple of thousand years have offered two reasons for aiming at the heights of moral goodness, to improve the world and to perfect one's self. These reasons do not sit together very well, since one of them is directed outward and the other is directed inward. Stop. They sit together beautifully, actually. As long as you don't harbor the notion of a separate self, This is the fundamental delusion from a Buddhist perspective, is thinking that there's this self here and there's the rest of the world out there and I have to choose between the two. But we know that in purifying our so-called own mind, we're purifying mind with a capital M. This distinction between self and other is just a human conceptual convention, ultimately. Yes, of course, there is a way in which each one of us is different, but everyone knows that. It's this other aspect, the aspect of oneness or unity, that is ignored in this particular statement he's making here. And it's because he's on the level of reason that he goes astray here. He says, these reasons do not sit very well together. No. But reason is just a fragment of this true mind of ours. So just as purifying our own mind through Zazen enables us to interact on a higher level with others and contribute to the good of the world, the greater good, let's say. Similarly, the case could be made, of course, all of you know this, that by sacrificing ourselves in the service of others, we have the possibility, it's a possibility anyway, the possibility of grinding away our own selfish preoccupations. But then, of course, it's much more complicated than that. And this is what he addresses. Can you really perfect your own self by forgetting it in the service of others? There are grounds, in fact, for thinking that being as good as possible is neither good for the world nor good for one's soul. Start with the soul part. Do those who devote their lives to the service of others tend to have beautiful, Socrates-like personalities? Well, no. Unnaturally developed moral virtues, patience, charity in thought as well as in deed, a constant concern with alleviating the suffering of others, tend to crowd out the non-moral virtues, like humor, intellectual curiosity, and dash. Susan Wolfe has distinguished two kinds of moral saint. The loving saint, capital L, capital S, whose happiness lies wholly and exclusively in helping others, and the rational saint, who is made happy by the same things as the rest of us, friends, family, material comforts, art, books, sports, sex, but who sacrifices his happiness out of a sense of duty. The loving saint, blind to so much of what life offers, has a soul that is strangely barren. The rational saint, who must continually suppress or deny his strongest desires, has a soul that is soured by frustration. I'm going to hold my powder for until we get deeper into this. It's a point that has regularly been made about the humanitarians who loom largest in the public imagination. Florence Nightingale, Mahatma Gandhi, Albert Schweitzer, Mother Teresa. He mentions someone who wrote a book about Victorians. The title is Eminent Victorians, made Florence Nightingale seem ludicrously inhuman. George Orwell scented a whiff of vanity emanating from Gandhi and concluded that sainthood is a thing that human beings must avoid. Albert Schweitzer has been condemned as a God-playing autocrat and racist. And most recently, Christopher Hitchens has set off a stink bomb at the shrine of Mother Teresa, making her out to be willfully obtuse about the suffering of others. Interestingly, Dorothy Day, the heroine of the Catholic worker movement, has so far escaped this sort of revisionist soul-blackening. Evidently, her saintliness was balanced by piquant elements left over from her bohemian libertine past. She had redeeming vices. Still, looking only at world-famous do-gooders leaves one open to the charge of selection bias. What happens when a fairly ordinary person takes up the cause of goodness with uncompromising zeal? This is dangerous territory when we set about to be good. Lao Tzu, the great Taoist sage, said, "The truly virtuous is not conscious of his virtue. The man of inferior virtue, however, is ever anxiously concerned with his virtue, and therefore he is without true virtue. True virtue is spontaneous and lays no claim to virtue." I would agree completely. And that, I think, is what we arrive at with a Zen understanding of all this, is the need to get beyond thinking of oneself as either or good enough or not good enough or anything else. More on that later. First, the author here, this review, he sketches out the main points of a novel in which a woman has an affair, a married woman has an affair, and then their marriage is sort of souring, the author of the novel says that her husband is not a very virtuous guy. He writes a mock bilious newspaper column called "The Angriest Man in Holloway," and is critical and snide about a lot of things. And then he, just to make this quick, in this fictitious account, he becomes a saint all of a sudden. He goes and to some kind of a healer who sucks the black mist out of him, and he becomes a saint. Wouldn't that be nice? No. And then the husband announces, "I think everything you think, but I'm going to walk it like I talk it," he declares to his astounded wife, who suspects a brain tumor. At first, David engages in random acts, trying to give away the Sunday roast on the street and donating one of the kids' computers to a battered women's shelter. Soon he undertakes a neighborhood-wide scheme to house the homeless in spare bedrooms. If David's soul is becoming more beautiful, the effect is lost on Katie. Her husband now strikes her as someone from whom all trace of facetiousness, every atom of self-irony, seems to have vanished. Defective as the old David was, he at least made her laugh, which, come to think of it, was why she married him in the first place. She detects a smugness, an ostentatiousness about his good works, which puts her triumphantly in mind of a passage from one of St. Paul's letters to the Corinthians. "Charity is not boastful nor proud. It vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, But when she quotes it to her husband, he reminds her that the very same passage was read at their wedding, with love in place of charity. Both words, he points out, are used to translate the Latin noun caritas. Love and charity share the same root word, she ponders to herself. How is that possible when everything in our recent history suggests that they cannot coexist, that they are antithetical, that if you put the two of them together in a sack, they would bite and scratch and scream until one of them is torn apart? What the hell is she talking about? Love and charity are antithetical to one another? I guess if you think of romantic love, where all of your attention is just turned inward to your beloved, and you sort of seal yourself off in your little loving unit, separate from the rest of the world and its problems, then okay. But love is the essence of charity, and oneness is the essence of love. You don't see the word love much in Zen texts, or even from, other than from Thich Nhat Hanh. There isn't much said about love, because I think I'm very comfortable with that, because love itself arises from something far deeper, which is oneness, an experience of the unity of all things and all beings. That's what we point to again and again in Zen. Same with morality. Morality itself springs from this sense of the interdependence, the oneness of all things, all beings. And so it's just the Zen style to go to the root and let the leaves and branches flourish as they will when we go to the root. And then the author goes to, I think goes even further astray when the wife has this epiphany that the real paragon of soul beauty is not the self-sacrificing do-gooder. It is someone who leads a rich and beautiful life, one filled with high artistic pleasures and exquisite personal affections. I think it's all too easy to make too much of artistic taste. We know that some of the most, the worst Nazis had this, fancied themselves as having this. Stories of guards, Nazi guards, who would, in the concentration camps, inflict all kinds of atrocities on other people, and then go home at night and listen to the strains of Beethoven and Bach and Mozart, and with great, great loving appreciation. And as far as personal affections, well, we all know that you can be awfully, awfully loving toward your own family or your own tribe, and to the same degree be hateful toward others. So I just don't follow her, this novelist, along that line. But there's something to it that we'll go on here. And then the reviewer presents some, gets into this, the ethical complexities of trying to be good all the time. Suppose you see a little girl drowning in a shallow pool of water. Wouldn't you feel duty-bound to rescue her? Never mind that jumping in the water means ruining your $200 shoes. Unfortunately, there are many children throughout the world in a situation analogous to that of the drowning girl. They are dying of starvation or of easily prevented maladies like diarrhea. And owing to the existence of a network of overseas relief organizations, it is within your power to save them. Indeed, the estimated cost of rescuing one child in this way has been put at about $200. All you have to do is call a toll-free number with your credit card in hand. Is there an important distinction between failing to do this and walking away from the drowning child? And if there is not, can you in good conscience stop at just $200? Don't your ethical convictions compel you to save as many children as your bank account permits? In the past several years, philosophers like Peter Singer of Princeton and Peter Unger of NYU have used such simple but intuitively powerful rescue cases to argue for an inconvenient conclusion. We rich Westerners should be giving away most of our money to international relief efforts. Doing so is not just praiseworthy, it is required by the ethical principles we all implicitly share. Singer himself has said that he gives away a fifth of his income and wonders whether that is enough. How could it be? Even if a middle-class American family were already giving up four-fifths of its household income to Oxfam, an incremental donation of $200 would save yet another child dying for lack of food or medical care at the cost of relatively little distress to the giver. As for the occasional sybaritic indulgence, forget it. What's a bottle of Dom Perignon compared to a child's life? If that's what morality asks of me, you might say, to hell with it. And Simon Blackburn, a philosopher at Cambridge, would probably sympathize with you. And this is, it introduces the second book that he's the reviewer is looking at. He argues in Being Good that this kind of over-demandingness threatens to undermine ethics itself. And then he says, the center of ethics must be occupied by things we can reasonably demand of each other, he writes. Our duty to help others cannot be infinite. The moral principles we adopt must not reduce us to slaves of the impersonal good. It may be praiseworthy to give away all your money in order to save starving children abroad, or to quit your Park Avenue medical practice and join Doctors Without Borders, or to invite the homeless to crash in your apartment, but it is not obligatory. The author says, these conclusions of Blackburn's are comforting, yet how are we to resist those rescue case arguments? And then it gets really interesting. One line of response goes something like this. Singer is an avowed utilitarian. In its purest form, utilitarianism says that we should seek to act in a way that brings about the greatest happiness in the world. This, by the way, is similar to the Mahayana Buddhist measure of giving or ethics is the greatest good for the greatest number. Now, that Zen is a little bit different, but that's the Mahayana Buddhist, of which Zen is one part. Now, one test of an ethical principle is that it be universalizable. We ask what the world would be like if everybody acted on this principle. What if everyone devoted himself to the happiness of others? Then, on average, everyone would be less happy, because everyone would be subordinating his own happiness to the needs of others. This just gets back to that same old dichotomy of self and other, and that's why it's flawed. But then he goes on, and if everyone gave all his money to Oxfam, the resulting contraction in consumer demand would cause the world economy to collapse, leading to enormous suffering. So these principles of doing good, you might think, are collectively self-defeating. And then the author here says, perhaps the minimum sacrifice morality requires of us is simply our fair share. The amount that, if everyone supplied it, would result in the most happiness and the least suffering in the world. This principle makes each individual's charitable burden quite reasonable. If you have already donated a modest sum to famine relief and done a little light ladling in the soup kitchen down at your local church, you can go ahead and pop that tin of Sevruga in good conscience, whatever that is. And then he says in parentheses, well, not entirely good conscience, because now we have to worry about the sturgeon. Any do-gooding you engage in beyond your fair share would be what ethicists call supererogatory, commendable to perform, but not blameworthy to omit. And suppose we do go beyond the call of duty. Even if we succeed in achieving some immediate good, there is no telling what the remoter consequences of our altruism will be. All we know is that these consequences will extend far into the future, beyond the purview of our will. Owing to the contingent and chaotic nature of cause and effect, the balance of good over evil involves something like a random walk, with unforeseen reversals at every stage. And then he says, consider the doctor who successfully delivered the fourth child of Clara and Alois Hitler after the couple's first three infants had tragically sickened and died. Skill can certainly help, as the examples of Oskar Schindler and Raoul Wallenberg show, but it is not always necessary. Is goodwill ever enough? Not unless it is combined with some other hard-to-define quality of character, which, waving our hands, we call nerve or heart. Whatever this quality is, it is one that most seemingly goodwill people lack, which is why they become silent accomplices when great evils are being committed. That's something we can all reflect on. We become silent accomplices when great evils are being committed. I think of the complexity of our president's decision as to whether to send great increase of troops into Afghanistan. I don't want to get into second-guessing him, but it's all so complex when you really, really examine, investigate the implications of any kind of action. In ordinary circumstances, of course, there remains the Oxfam option. Yet even here, there is no fixed proportion between the will to do good and the good one actually does. The widow's mite, which I suppose he means the widow's tiny donation, for all the benevolence behind it, is null compared with the face-saving millions given to charities by the heartless capitalist. So exceptional goodness always seems to require special qualifications, either great savoir-faire or great bravery plus exposure to extreme circumstances that call for moral heroism. If you happen to be short on both counts, you're probably out of the running. Sainthood, it turns out, is one of those career prospects, like making millions in mail order, that seem to be open to everyone but pan out for only the fortunate few. Beyond the necessary technical and organizational skills, achieving great altruistic feats seems to require a sort of demonic creativity. Florence Nightingale, who dedicated her life to the care of the war wounded, did an enormous amount of good. And then he says, although her reforms, by reducing the human cost of war, might have made future wars more likely. But Nightingale was not a sweet, self-abnegating angel of mercy. She was an angry, acerbic, sarcastic, and self-important woman of stern and indomitable will. She had, you could say, an artist's temperament. Evelyn Waugh once observed, "Humility is not a virtue propitious to the artist. It is often pride, emulation, avarice, malice, which drive one to complete, elaborate, refine, destroy, renew his work until he has made something that gratifies his pride and envy and greed. And in doing so, he enriches the world more than the generous and good, though he may lose his own soul in the process. That is the paradox of artistic achievement." And then the author says, it may also be the paradox of altruistic achievement. If you want to be a saint, forget about being an angel. Abraham Lincoln pointed to the same thing when he said, "It has been my experience that folks who have no vices have very few virtues." Now we're going to leave the world of philosophical analysis, which really is what we've been reading, and try to get beyond philosophy to what we can do to resolve this matter of virtue, but in particular, how much to give to whom and when and so forth and how. It's a hall of mirrors. We've talked in past teshos about being approached by someone on the street who asks for a buck when we don't know how that dollar will be spent, wine or drugs or something else. What do we do in that situation? It's much more immediate situation that we're likely to face than these larger, more abstract things. In Zen, we would say that the key to knowing how to respond is in our ability to empty our mind of all of these concepts of the greater good, the lesser good, and certainly this notion of a self that can be either good or not good. And that's what is radical about Zen teaching, is that it goes beyond ethics, beyond ethical considerations. And this is also one thing that distinguishes Zen from Buddhism in general. There are untold numbers of books that investigate Buddhist ethics. But in Zen, Zen rests on faith in the good with a capital G that arises from an empty mind. That is, a mind that is fully present and able to embody through our arms and our eyes to embody our own true nature. it rests Zen ethics, if you can even call it ethics, rests on faith in our innate purity and completeness. I came across another article that lends some support to this faith in our innate purity and willingness to help. This is from the New York Times of a few days ago, and the title is "We May Be Born with an Urge to Help." It's by Nicholas Wade. What is the essence of human nature? Flawed, say many theologians. Vicious and addicted to warfare, wrote Hobbes. Selfish and in need of considerable improvement, think many parents. But biologists are beginning to form a generally sunnier view of humankind. Their conclusions are derived in part from testing very young children, and partly from comparing human children with those of chimpanzees, hoping that the differences will point to what is distinctly human. The somewhat surprising answer at which some biologists have arrived is that babies are innately sociable and helpful to others. Of course, every animal must to some extent be selfish to survive, but the biologists also see in humans a natural willingness to help. When infants 18 months old see an unrelated adult whose hands are full and who needs assistance opening a door or picking up a dropped clothespin, they will immediately help. Michael Tomasello writes in Why We Cooperate, a book published in October. The helping behavior seems to be innate because it appears so early and before many parents start teaching children the rules of polite behavior. Dr. Tomasello finds the helping is not enhanced by rewards, suggesting that it is not influenced by training. It seems to occur across cultures that have different timetables for teaching social rules. And helping behavior can even be seen in infant chimpanzees under the right experimental conditions. For all these reasons, Dr. Tomasello concludes that helping is a natural inclination, not something imposed by parents or culture. So it's some kind of an instinct, according to this research. It is our nature to reach out, to lend a hand, to give. There's a koan in the Blue Cliff Record where one enlightened monk says to another, what use does the bodhisattva of compassion make of all those hands and arms? And the other master, his name is Dogo, his Japanese name is Dogo, these are both Chinese masters, he says, it is like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow with outstretched hand in the middle of the night. It is like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow with outstretched hand in the middle of the night. When we take refuge in Buddha, which here at the center is something we do in the beginning of a chanting service, just about every day, when we take refuge in Buddha, we're really taking refuge, not just in our own Buddha nature, but more specifically as well, in our bodhisattva nature. It means to place our faith in our kanon nature. That we don't have to learn to be helpful or compassionate. It's not strictly speaking, it's not a matter of acquiring learning at it, but it's rather freeing the mind of the conceptual shackles that bind us, that bind our impulse to give, to reach out. It's a matter of through zazen releasing that profound movement to reach out to others, freeing ourselves. To put it another way, what prevents us from giving or wanting to help? Not wanting, that complicates it. What prevents us from responding helpfully or generously to others? It is our mental conditioning, our tendency to hold back, to withhold spiritual material aid. And that withholding comes from being bound up with our conceptual stuff in the mind. We could say that our practice is immature to the degree that we don't step forward and reach out to help others. And even though I said we don't in Zen, it's not a matter of learning something, still we can exercise that impulse to respond to others in need in the simplest ways. And this is part of what training means, is learning to respond. And even in that very way, someone is walking, approaching a door with their hands full, step forward, open the door. And of course there are many other those kinds of concrete examples of how we have the opportunity all the time. We're at the supermarket and something happens like that. Do we stand and watch? Or do we respond? Physically respond, of course. And what we find is, first of all, the more sitting we do, the more likely we are to respond and not be lost in our thoughts. The less likely we are to be paralyzed at those times. And the more sitting we do, the more likely we are. And coming from the other side, the more often we do that, we get physically responding to things, the easier it becomes, the more natural it becomes. What else causes us to hold back when we have the opportunity to help? It's really the same thing. The attachment, conceptual attachment, but at center, it's attachment to the notion of self and other. If I do this, then that cuts into my free time, and I need my free time in this little way, so I'm not going to. It's dividing into what we see as mine and what we see as others. Of course, there's also this aspect of self-care, what at our Zen teachers' meetings we call self-care, where we all have to take good enough care of ourselves that we have the resources to give and respond to others. And that's what, again, is so complex, is weighing that or knowing how much we need for ourselves and how much we can simply devote to others. A little more on this article. Infants will help with information as well as in practical ways. From the age of 12 months, they will point at objects that an adult pretends to have lost. Chimpanzees, by contrast, never point at things for each other. And when they point for people, it seems to be as a command to go fetch something rather than to share information. For parents who may think their children somehow skipped the cooperative phase, Dr. Tomasello offers the reassuring advice that children are often more cooperative outside the home, which is why parents may be surprised to hear from a teacher or coach how nice their child is. And then he says, in families, the competitive element is in ascendancy, he said. As children grow older, they become more selective in their helpfulness. Starting around age 3, they will share more generously with the child who has previously been nice to them. Children are altruistic by nature, Tomasello writes, and though they are also naturally selfish, all parents need do is try to tip the balance toward social behavior. And this points to the dual nature of each one of us, is that even as we have this pristine, bright and pure mind, Buddha mind, Bodhisattva mind, we also have to struggle with these three poisons that arise from ignorance of the true nature of things. The three poisons being greed, hostility, and delusion, greed, anger, and delusion. Sen does not deny our selfish tendencies. It just says that even beneath those selfish tendencies is this mind of luminous compassion and helpfulness. And then he says, Dr. Tomasello said, that's why we have moral dilemmas, because we are both selfish and altruistic at the same time. Someone once called, when I first read this about children, as children, how we are so naturally helpful. Someone once called Zen practice psychologically adaptive regression. There's something to that. Long practice will leave us with more and more a mind of wonder, which is one of the most beautiful things about children, this mind of openness and wonder. I think we've run out of time, so we'll stop now and recite the four vows.